Brothers and sisters in the Dharma, Namo Buddhaya, Jai Bhim.
Jai Bhim.
So welcome everybody once again to the Papaloka Shrine Room. You're joining our Wednesday day retreat, and this is the day on which I give a talk on the Bodhicharya Avatara. And once again, I'd just like to thank those of you who've been listening to the talks for the very kind comments you've made about the talks. I keep getting emails and postcards and letters from people saying how much they appreciate not just hearing the talk, but being in the Shrine Room with the Padmaloka community. People are saying that they find it a great help, a great source of support and inspiration. So we're very, very pleased to hear that. That's very important to us, because as I've said before, we're in really good, almost, well, monastic type conditions, and we've got quite a program of meditation and study and work and communication with one another and leisure time. So we're having a really fine time here at Padmaloka, at the same time very well aware of what's going on in the outside world. So it's very, very important for us that you do communicate with us. We appreciate it very much. Today we're coming to chapter 5 of the Bodhicharya Avatara, Samprajanya Rakshana, the guarding of total awareness, which is all about mindfulness. It's all about mindfulness. This is what this chapter is about. But before I start getting into that, start looking at Shantideva's text, I want to refer to something from Bhante's life, from Sangharakshita's life. On October the 12th, 1962, Bhante received his Bodhisattva ordination from the Venerable Dada Rinpoche at the old Bhutan Palace in Kalimpong. And this was a very, very important moment in Sangharakshita's spiritual journey. I think he said on one occasion it was one of the happiest days of his life, if not the happiest day of his life, formally entering into the Mahayana Sangha, being ordained as a Bodhisattva by Dada Rinpoche. He'd always admired the Bodhisattva ideal from a very, very young age, been very inspired by a book called The Vows of Samantabhadra, which comes from the Gandavyuha Sutra. He'd studied Shantideva's Shiksha Samuchaya in an old translation and was just generally very inspired by the sublimity of the Mahayana ideal and the ideal of the being who strives to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. It was a very important inspiration and support for him. But he said with that ordination, he'd moved from admiring to actually committing himself to the Bodhisattva path. And he asked Rinpoche, Dada Rinpoche, to ordain him as a Bodhisattva, because he knew Dada Rinpoche very well. He'd known him for a number of years. And he said on one occasion to some of us that he had a very critical mind. He has a very critical mind, and he really observed people. It's quite an interesting thought. And he'd really observed Dada Rinpoche, and he said he'd come to the conclusion that he really was a living Bodhisattva, that Dada Rinpoche really exemplified to quite a high degree the six paramitas. He also noted that he had this extraordinary mindfulness, this mindfulness to a very, very high degree, almost to a sort of supernatural degree. And it was one of the reasons why he was so glad as well from Rinpoche to receive the White Tara initiation, White Tara with her seven eyes, which really illustrates this fullness of mindfulness and awareness. And as he wasn't the only person in the Bodhisattva ordination, Bhikkhu Kantipalo, who was a friend of Bhante's, they received the ordination together. Bhante said he can't remember the details of the ordination itself so much, but he does remember the very, very strong bond that he felt with Rinpoche and Venerable Kantipalo. And after the ceremony, Rinpoche explained to Bhante the 18 major and 46 minor precepts, the Sangvarashila, that go with that particular form of the Bodhisattva ordination. These are the root and branch downfalls from the Bodhisattva vow, sometimes they say from the Bodhicitta, which sometimes we have studied. And Bhante then made a translation of those precepts with Dada Rinpoche. And I remember Bhante saying that Rinpoche explained these precepts, the meaning of these precepts, according to the tradition of Tsongkhapa, in great detail, very, very fully, very thoroughly. In fact, in my relation to the order, Bhante said that one of his literary projects, which unfortunately never came to fruition, was a commentary on those Bodhisattva precepts. It's a great shame that that's one of the great unwritten papers of Bhante. And, you know, we've tried to make up for it with our own explorations of it. But it's a great shame that we missed that opportunity. Perhaps we should have entreated Bhante more at the time. But the reason why I'm mentioning this is because we've looked in the section on Bodhicitta Parigraha, which is where we have the great vows of Shantideva, the great vows of the Bodhisattva, the great commitment to the Bodhisattva path. Last week we looked at vigilance in relation to that, vigilance in relation to these vows. You know, this awareness of the consequences of breaking the vow that Shantideva mentions, we explored that. Today, though, it's a bit of a different emphasis. What we're doing now, what Shantideva is doing now, is seeing how Bodhisattva practice comes into the everyday, into the specific, into the nitty-gritty of life, which is what those Bodhisattva precepts that Bhante received from Rinpoche are really all about. It's looking at the way in which someone committed to the Bodhisattva ideal, to the Bodhisattva vow, actually practices day to day. They're very specific. They're very much to do with their times and their culture. They need a fair bit of interpretation, although some of them are to do with great general principles. So this is really the great concern of this section, but it all comes out of mindfulness. It all comes out of mindfulness. And what we're really dealing with here today is a Bodhisattva's mindfulness. The Bodhisattva's mindfulness. So the title of the chapter is Guarding Total Awareness. Samprajanya Rakshana. Samprajanya is probably quite a familiar term to many of you. Samprajanya, I think it is in Pali. So it's not always clear what the translation is. Total awareness is, excuse me, what's given in the Sanskrit dictionary, can be translated as clear comprehension. Sometimes it's described as mindfulness of purpose, mindfulness of your overall purpose. Sometimes it almost seems that the other term that is also used in this section, smriti, sati in Pali, they're almost interchangeable. Sati samprajanya, smriti samprajanya. It's quite interesting to see that. But I think the basic idea is that sati, smriti, is to do with recollecting what you're doing, coming into awareness of yourself now and in the moment. Samprajanya is more to do with the overall purpose of your life, the overall purpose of your Dharma life. This is explored in quite a lot of detail. This is a huge area, a hugely rich field of Dharma practice. I remember one occasion where Bhante was talking to us about mindfulness and, you know, in a way, revealing how unmindful we actually are as a community. No, I don't mean Padmaloka, I mean the Tri Ratna community and the need for much greater mindfulness. He said he thought there was a huge and rich field of spiritual practice that we were neglecting. mindfulness, Smriti Samprajanya, because that is an area of practice that can go on, should be going on all the time. It's not for any special place, it's for everything, for all the time. I want to just, before going any further, I've mentioned that Samprajanya is mindfulness of purpose. Let's have a look a bit more at Smriti, because he uses this word quite a lot. This corresponds to Sati in Pali. I'm going to read something from a seminar that Bhante did on the Buddhavagga, the section on the Buddha from the Dhammapada. And I want to read it because I think it's just brilliant the way Bhante talks here about the meaning of the word Sati, the Pali for Smriti. So he's commenting on a word in the text called Satimant, in that Pali text. So the enlightened ones are called Satimant. Here's Bhante. The literal meaning of Sati is recollection, or in a way, memory, or calling to mind. Thus the English word recollect is quite significant, for it means to recollect. Usually the contents of your mind are in a scattered state, so you recollect them. And because you recollect them, you yourself are recollected. Thus there is a connection with mindfulness, or being full of mind, which one can say is a further stage of development in the same direction. To be fully collected or recollected is to be satimata, mindful. Sometimes the etymology of a word can give us a clue to its real meaning. Thus, when you are mindful, everything you do is full of mind, or is imbued with awareness. Not that this awareness is somehow superimposed on what you do, but it wholly permeates it. You don't just stand aside from yourself and watch yourself. On the contrary, you are in yourself and with yourself while you are doing something. The mindfulness is not a sort of extra quality. It is something that saturates the whole of what you do, and which is indistinguishable from it. Mindfulness saturates the natural flow. It is like a colouring being given to the flow. I think that's a really brilliant, beautiful description of mindfulness, of everything being full of mind, everything being full of purpose, everything being filled with Smriti, Samprajanya. And this is what we're going to be exploring. This is what Shantideva addresses in Samprajanya Rakshana. The Bodhisattva needs to be full of mind, needs to be constantly recollecting their purpose of gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings in all the details of life, both inside and outside. That's what we're going to be opening up here. Before moving on to mindfulness, Shantideva makes it very clear why it's so crucial. So I'm going to read you some verses that open this section from Shantideva. It's good. There's going to be quite a few verses from Shantideva today. I think it's very important to hear his words. One who wishes to guard his training in the bodhicitta must scrupulously guard his mind. It is impossible to guard one's training without guarding the wandering mind. Rutting elephants roaming wild do not cause as much devastation in this world as the roaming elephant the mind let free creates in Avicii and other hells. But if the roaming elephant, the mind, is tethered on every side by the cord of mindfulness, every danger subsides and complete good ensues. So too, tigers, lions, elephants, bears, serpents, and all malign beings and all the guards of hell, ogresses, demons, all these are bound through the binding of a single mind. And through the taming of a single mind, all are tamed. Since all fears and incomparable sufferings arise from the mind alone, so it was taught by the teacher of reality. Who fashioned the weapons in hell so industriously? Who the pavement of scalding iron? And who sired those sirens? All of this arises from the evil mind, sang the sage. So there is nothing dangerous in the three worlds other than the mind. So he really brings out, and it's a huge theme in this section, the centrality of the mind, the power of the mind, the power of citta. I was looking at Bhante's commentary on this section in The Endlessly Fascinating Cry, and he said a very interesting thing. When you do a thought act, a mind act, because action, thoughts and emotions, the actions of citta are actions. They have a karmic effect. And of course, the word citta doesn't just mean mind in the sense of thought. It also means heart. It also means volition. It means all those things. But Bhante said that citta, when you act with citta, you're letting loose a force in the universe. And we know that he's talked about the bodhicitta being a force in the universe. Well, our own minds are actually letting force, letting a force out into the universe. It's quite a thought, a very, very powerful thought indeed, a rather scary thought, that what we do with our minds has huge effects. Of course, this is standard Dhamma. This goes back to the first two verses of the Dhammapada. It's a great theme of the Dhammapada. There's a whole section on citta, the mind, and so on. But just to really bring home the power of the mind, Shantideva likens the untrained mind to a roaming, untamed, rutting elephant. Mata Martanga. An elephant in must, as they call it in India. A randy elephant charging around. Apparently they're very, very frightening. I have read stories and accounts of crazed elephants, you know, on the go, as it were. And they cause it in tremendous devastation. Shantideva is saying this. I think his images and his metaphors are there to, it's very easy to skip over them. We've actually got to imagine that. He's trying to get us to feel that our mind is like that. Our mind has that power, that force. And the untrained mind, the mind that's just at the mercy of the defilements, that is itself defilements, is like that very, very destructive elephant. But of course, and he doesn't go into this in this section, not explicitly, it also, of course, it means that the mind can be powerfully good. It can do tremendous good, and we mustn't forget that either. In a later section, in the section on Virya, the Shantideva likens the Bodhisattva's pure energy, his Virya, which all comes from the mind, from the citta, as being insatiable for its acts of goodness. He said it's like an elephant enraged by the heat of the midday sun plunging into cool water. And there are other places where the Bodhisattva's activity is likened to a playful elephant playing with lotus flowers and so on and so forth. So I think that's quite important that yes, he's emphasizing, Shantideva, how powerful the mind is and how destructive it can be. But there's another side that we must also remember, that we can do great acts of goodness with our mind. Everything stems from the mind. In this section, he says we train the mind through the cord, through the rope of mindfulness, smriti, sati. That's how we train the mind, constant mindfulness. Later on, Shantideva talks about tying the elephant of the mind to the stake of mindfulness. You know, just trying to get it under control, as it were, trying to direct it. There's another image. They like the images for the mind in Buddhist tradition to these very, very powerful creatures. In I think it's Buddhaghosa in the Visuddhimagga who describes the whole process of concentration, particularly in a practice like the mindfulness of breathing. He said it's just like training a bull, training a powerful young bull. First you've got to catch it, then you tie it to a stake. And of course what the bull will do, he'll want to pull it out of the ground. But after a while, he'll just start going round in a circle. And then eventually he'll just sit down because he knows he's not going to get away. That's what the process of concentration is like. And we know that, don't we? That when we do something like the mindfulness of breathing, our mind is here, it's there, it's pulling away very powerfully. We keep tying the mind to the mindfulness of the breath and eventually it settles. All that power, all that energy is harnessed for whatever direction we want to go in. It's very interesting, quite topical, because in the field opposite Padmaloka at the moment, there's the great bull has arrived. I don't think he's going to be settling down too much because the field is full of cows. But never mind, he's certainly not going to go on the rampage in relation to Padmaloka. But anyway, it's good to have a good look at the bull and recognise, well, that's what our minds are like. Shantideva goes on and said it's the mind that perfects the paramitas of dana and sila. You would expect at this stage in the Bodhicharyavatara that that's what he'd deal with, those paramitas. But he doesn't do that. He wants to talk about what underlies the paramitas. So he says, if the perfection of generosity consists in making the universe free from poverty, how can the previous protectors have acquired it when the world is still poor, even today? The perfection of generosity is said to result from the mental attitude of relinquishing all that one has to all people, together with the fruit of that act. Therefore, the perfection is the mental attitude itself. This could be misunderstood. This could be a rationalization for not actually giving stuff to people in need. And Shantideva doesn't mean it in that way. Andrew Skilton and Kate Crosby, in their commentary on this, wonder if what Shantideva has in mind is the very conventional practice of generosity that would have been around in Shantideva's day, which wasn't real giving, not coming out of the real spirit, the real attitude of generosity, but simply to do with, you know, some idea of making merit. We're in a very different world ourselves. We do need to actually give in so many ways, but it must come out of the spirit of generosity, the spirit of giving up and giving away. We talked about this, we explored this last week, where in that verse where Shantideva says, Nirvana is the giving up of all, and my heart yearns for Nirvana. If I am to give up everything, then let me give it to beings. That's the sort of spirit behind the perfection of generosity. So the mind has got to be fully involved in this. The citta, the heart, has to be fully involved. Then he says, where can fish and other creatures be taken where I might not kill them? Yet when the mental attitude to cease from worldly acts is achieved, that is agreed to be the perfection of morality. How many wicked people, as unending as the sky, can I kill? But when the mental attitude of anger is slain, slain is every enemy. So he's saying it's mindfulness. It's the trained mind that underpins ethics. This is very, very important in terms of the perfection of ethics. Later on in the text, Shantideva mentions the various ethical practices that the Bodhisattva undertakes. But the point is, if they're not accompanied with awareness and mindfulness, they become stupid in some cases, because you can end up doing things which actually don't really benefit people because you've got a narrow idea of morality. Awareness needs to be constantly practice. We need to be constantly mindful in order to perform our ethical practice. He goes a bit further and just talks about practices. The All-Knowing One declared that all recitation of mantras, and all austerity, and by this he means spiritual practice generally, even though performed over a long time, are completely useless if the mind is on something else or is dull. So if our mind is elsewhere, you know, we can't do anything with our meditation. There won't be any fruits of meditation. If our mind is elsewhere when we're studying, there won't be any fruits of study. If our mind is elsewhere when we're reciting, well, there won't be any fruits from reciting. It's even said that when you listen to a Dharma talk, there is no value in it unless your mind is fully present. The great teachers make a lot of this, that if you're not fully present in a Dharma talk with your mind, the Dharma talk is valueless. What is heard, reflected upon, or cultivated in meditation, like water in a leaky jar, does not stay in the memory of a mind which lacks awareness. Many, though learned, possessing faith, and though absorbed in effort, are befouled by offences due to the fault of lacking awareness. He goes on like this, and really pointing out how fully present that we need to be in order to make the most of our Dharma lives. And at the end of one of these sections, he says, he makes a strong vow. Therefore, I should manage and guard my mind well. If I let go of the vow to guard my mind, what will become of my many other vows? Let my possessions freely perish, my honour, my body and life, and let other good things perish, but never the mind. Never the mind. A bit later on, he has a real critique of the body, which we'll come to. It's the mind, awareness, purpose, we must not let go of. I make this salutation with my hands to those who wish to guard their mind. With all your effort, guard both mindfulness and full awareness. You know, very, very powerful, teaching. He really means it. I must admit, I just a bit of a confession here. I found this a particularly difficult section to prepare, and there are going to be lots of chunks of text from the Bodhicharyavatara. And I think what that indicates, like the conclusion I'm coming to, my lack of mindfulness, my lack of appreciation of the importance of the mind, and my willingness to just allow my mind to be distracted and self-indulgent. So though I might be very enthusiastic in doing this presentation, in this not coming from a great deal of experience, but I'm definitely on Shantideva's side. I do want to put that little caveat in, because those of you who know me well know that I'm not a great exemplar of mindfulness. So the mind has great power. It has great potential for damage. It has great potential for good. It makes all practices, dana, sila, all of our meditation practices and studies effective. And it's highly sensitive. It's not only powerful like a great elephant. It's highly sensitive. Shantideva, I mean, his metaphors are fantastic. He talks about the mind being like a wound. It's so sensitive. A wound. I mean, it's almost like, I do sometimes wonder if he's trying to get us to, well, visualize your mind as a wound. It's not very attractive. But you know, the point he makes, you know, when you have a wound somewhere on your body, well, you're very, very careful what you do with it. You know, you don't want it to get infected. You don't want it to bang into anything. You know, you're really going to be protective. He says, the mind is like that. You know, especially when defilements are there or potentially there. You might even think that you've removed the defilements. Well, the mind is still extraordinarily sensitive. And he says, you really need to protect it. You need to protect it with mindfulness and a sense of purpose, especially when you go into dangerous situations, especially when you're in bad company. Durjana, I think the word is, Durjana, bad company, bad people, and or people who you're likely to get very attracted to, very, very dangerous situation. You've really got to protect your mind because it's so sensitive, and I think that's something to perhaps particularly bear in mind at the moment, where we're all in this kind of, many of us in almost this enforced retreat situation. We are going to be much more sensitive to what we take in. Everything is going to be more heightened, and we need to be aware of the impact of what we're taking in on our minds and take great care with it. I remember, just to illustrate this, I remember once a particular experience of Bhante, of Sangharakshita, who is an extraordinarily mindful person, an extraordinarily mindful person. And I'd come back from India in the early 80s, and I went to see him. He was staying at Sakavati at the London Buddhist Centre in his flat there, and I went to see him, and he and a few others were going into central London. Bhante wanted to go and see one of his beloved bookshops down in central London, Tottenham Court Road, Charing Cross Road. And I said, oh yeah, I'd love to come. So I thought, great, you know, we'll go with Bhante, have a chat. It's very interesting. As soon as we got out of the door of the LBC, Bhante was just extraordinarily focused. He moved very mindfully, but fast, down Roman Road to the tube station. There was no looking to left or right. There was no conversation. I was with, you know, the other guys who were going, we were having a sort of chat, thinking that Bhante would join in. No, completely focused, down the escalator, eyes not looking to left or right. And it's not that he wasn't aware of everything around him, but there was just this focus on the tube, focus. Up the escalator, you know, down into Charing Cross Road, into the bookshop, focus. Total focus. You know, I'm sort of looking at all the adverts and, you know, probably all sorts of things I shouldn't have been looking at. Into the bookshop, total focus. It was only when we got into the cafe afterwards that we started to, he was chatty. We had a chat talking about the books that were bought, really warm, really expansive. Soon as we left the cafe to go back, mindfulness again. Total protection of awareness. Total protection of awareness. But at the same time, notice also how that changes in a different circumstance. When we're at in the cafe having tea and coffee together, he's not attached to a mode of mindfulness. But I really had the sense of somebody really protecting their awareness, really making sure that the awareness wasn't in any way tired out by all the sort of sights and sounds of central London. It's very, very powerful. I'll never forget that. So this brings us, talking like this, talking about being with a teacher, to Shantideva's discussion of how to develop mindfulness. So here are some verses. Mindfulness comes easily to those fortunate people who practice wholeheartedly through the instruction of their preceptor, because they live with their teacher and out of fear. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have unobstructed vision in all directions. Every single thing is before them. Before them I stand. Meditating like this, one should remain possessed of shame, respect and fear. One should recollect the Buddhas in this way at every moment. Awareness comes, and once come does not go again, if mindfulness remains at the door to the mind in order to guard it. So just go into this a little bit, this how to develop mindfulness. Well, first of all, you know, how mindfulness comes easily. First of all, practice wholeheartedly. Practice wholeheartedly. If you want to be mindful, you need wholehearted practice. It goes back to that whole discussion of recollecting our scattered selves. If we really want to be mindful, we've got to gather ourselves. We've got to train in meditation and concentration. We've got to learn how to do that, to bring ourselves together. I remember on the Tuscany ordination course that I supported in 1984, again, there was a whole discussion about mindfulness that we had with Bhante. You know, it's been a recurring theme of discussions in seminars with Bhante. And I remember him making the point, people were suggesting ways to promote mindfulness, you know, that, well, maybe we could have slogans up on the walls to remind us to be mindful and things like that. And he said, yes, but Bhante said you'd forget to look at them. You know, and they wouldn't remind you of anything anymore because you wouldn't look at them. And I think it was Kamala Sheela said, Bhante, you seem to be saying, in order to be mindful, you have to really want to be mindful. And Bhante said, that's exactly it. You have to really want to be mindful. Your heart needs to be in it. You have to understand why mindfulness is so important and what it really is, what it really means to, you know, fill your life with mind, feel everything with awareness, and why it's so very, very important. So we need to practice wholeheartedly. And if we practice wholeheartedly, of course, we'll meet spiritual friends. We will want to be with people who are more aware, who are more switched on, who are more mindful, more awake, more alert, who have more of a sense of purpose. We'll want to be around them. We'll even want to commit ourselves, you know, to the Buddhist path. We'll want to go for refuge. We'll want to have a preceptor. So he talks, Shantideva, about, well, it comes easily if you have the instruction of the Upadhyaya, the preceptor, the Upadhyaya Anushasinya. I think that's the Sanskrit. The precept of the Lama, this brings up from Atisha's Kadampa tradition, the precept of the preceptor, the particular instruction, the pith instruction, the essential instruction on how to apply mindfulness and awareness and your practice generally in your life, in the details of life. This is why it's so important to be with spiritual friends. You know, that so often, you know, living with spiritual friends, you know, living with Kalyana Mitras, living with, you know, our fellows on the path, our brothers and sisters on the path, or getting together with them on retreat or to the extent we can, we learn so much about how to apply the Dharma, how to apply mindfulness to the details of life. The precepts, the teachings are general. You know, they're sort of general principles. We have to learn how to apply them moment by moment. And that comes through close communication with spiritual friends. So practice wholeheartedly. Listen to the instruction of the preceptor. And live, if you can, with your teacher. Live around somebody who's mindful. Live around people who are mindful in the broadest and deepest sense. I think when I say mindful, I think don't get the idea that mindfulness is just one kind of thing. Like very, you know, paying very close attention to how you eat a raisin or something like that, which I'm sure is a really wonderful and important thing. But that's only one aspect of mindfulness. Shantideva is describing a whole life. A whole life, a life of total, all-pervading awareness, a total training. So be part of a mindful community in that sense. If you can live with them, great. Have as much contact with mindful people, aware people, alert people as you possibly can, people living wholeheartedly for the Dharma. Shantideva talks about fear here. As well, he talks about fear and shame and blame and all these sorts of things. These are very positive emotions as far as he's concerned. He's not talking about fear in the sense of you know, cowing down before people. It means a sober awareness of consequences, of letting go of mindfulness. Shame, apatrapya, shame in relation to the wise. These are highly positive, skillful states. This is what makes ethics possible. Ethics is a sensibility, an awareness. It's that burning that you feel when you go against your ideals, when you go against the Bodhisattva ideal, Bodhisattva vow, your commitment to that. One of the meanings of sati, smriti, is conscience. There's this sort of idea that somehow mindfulness is neutral. It's got nothing to do with skillful and unskillful. It's without any value judgment. Well, this is a complete slander of what the Buddhist tradition means by mindfulness. Mindfulness is intrinsically ethical. If you're mindful, it's impossible to be unethical. Mindfulness itself is imbued with conscience and ethical sensibility and awareness of others and your values. And he says, well, okay, if you can't live with spiritual friends and teachers, well, you can still practice mindfulness because the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are everywhere. They're there. They're witnessing our spiritual practice. Shantideva really believes this. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are presences in his life. We're sitting in a shrine room full of images to remind us of the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So this is a tremendous way of practicing mindfulness, the practice of recollection of the Buddha, Buddhanusmriti, Buddhanusati, which goes right back to the time of the Buddha, just remembering the Buddha, remembering the Buddhas, remembering the Bodhisattvas in the Mahayana tradition. Of course, this is very inspirational. It's very important, I think, when we take up the practice of mindfulness, that we're genuinely inspired by the vision of mindfulness. It would be good to meditate on, you know, when you're doing a recollection of the Buddha practice. Well, imagine what it would be like to be with the mindfulness of the Buddha. The mindfulness of the Buddha, this field of recollection, this field of mind, of citta, and of presence that would be emanating from him. You get that impression in the Pali scriptures that people would come into the field of the Buddha and they would become mindful. They would become mindful. This is what you're really doing in the recollection of the Buddha practice, the mindfulness of the Buddha practice. Your mindfulness of the Buddha is opening up to his transcendental mindfulness. The nearest I've come to the Buddha is, I'm not saying he's enlightened, is Bhante. And, you know, sometimes when I meditate, I bring Bhante to mind because I have meditated with Bhante. And I always have a sense of when I bring Bhante to mind of being with somebody who is really mindful, really still, really recollected, and bringing him to mind inspires me to be more mindful. So we can practice like this. Yes, it's wonderful. I know that we've got all the wonderful online facilities at the moment. That's great, and I'm glad people are meeting and listening to spiritual friends online. But don't forget your imagination. Don't forget the mental action of mindfulness, of bringing the Buddha, bringing the Bodhisattvas to mind, even bringing your spiritual friends to mind in your homes, in your communities. Don't just rely on, you know, the electronic media. It's wonderful though it is. Develop that muscle in yourself of recollecting the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. That's so important, that our own mind is saturated with the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I remember Bhante once saying that this is particularly perhaps for older members, and it's a way of talking about what he calls mindfulness of reality itself in his lecture on the dimensions of awareness. He said, if you're doing a sadhana, a visualization practice, which older members do, there comes a point in your practice where what will happen is that you're living by the reality principle, the spiritual principle that the Buddha or Bodhisattva embodies. So he said, for example, Manjugosha. So he said, your whole life becomes pervaded by the Manjugosha principle. You're seeing everything in those terms. That's mindfulness. So mindfulness is can also be this constant awareness of reality in this form, pervading everything that you do, so that when you then come to meditate, say, on Manjugosha, he will emerge in whatever way he chooses, as it were. Buddha Ghosha says one of the marks of recollection of the Buddha, successful meditation on the Buddha, is that your body becomes a shrine room. Your body becomes a shrine room. You know, because all the time you're carrying the Buddha with you, inside you. Your body becomes, as it were, a temple, a shrine, a place of worship. So, of course, you're only going to act appropriately. You're not going to do anything that would be against the Buddha, that would be inappropriate. So there'll be constant mindfulness of all your actions and of all your behaviour. In the next section, Shantideva goes on to talk about mindfulness of the body and its movements. This is a sort of classical description of mindfulness of the body and its movements. This is a very important theme for Shantideva, as it is throughout the tradition, this constant sense of positive self-possession. He talks at, you know, the classic description where you walk with your eyes just dead out. I think it's a plough length ahead, as you would in meditation, walking very mindfully, but also aware from time to time of the horizon, of the overall field of awareness. You're not just doing that rigidly. You're relaxed in that. This is the way he talks. But this is a very important detail for me. If someone comes to you, you don't just carry on like that. You welcome them. So if somebody comes towards you, you don't selfishly carry on with your mindfulness of the body and its movements. I think some people misunderstand the practice of mindfulness in among modern Western Buddhists, that you just sort of ignore everybody else. This isn't what Shantideva says. If somebody comes into your field of vision, you welcome them. Suswagatam is the Sanskrit word, a beautiful word. You give them friendly welcome. It might not need to be in words. If you're, say, on a silent retreat, it might not have to involve that at all, but there's just a warm expression to them. In other words, you're mindful of other people as much as you are of your body and its movements. But yes, there's this description of a constant awareness of the body and its posture, aware of how your body's sitting, whether it's standing, walking, lying down, and mindfulness of the whole scene. This is explored. And he talks about this in order to, because you have a responsibility, he says, to develop samadhi. As a bodhisattva, you're using mindfulness to develop samadhi, to develop full concentration and absorption. And of course, you're going to be doing samadhi, particularly in meditation. I think this is one of the reasons why Bhante has emphasized mindfulness so much in relation to meditation practice on so many occasions. He said, well, people don't make progress in meditation because they're not mindful enough in daily life. There's too much of a disparity between what they're doing on the cushion and what they're doing in the rest of their life. Shantideva does give exceptions to this very self-possessive mindfulness, which, you know, sounds quite sort of slow and calm. He says, if there's a danger arising to self and other, if there's a moment of sort of spiritual inspiration and elation, you let that go. You let that go. You respond to what is happening. Again, I think this is important because sometimes, you know, you can see people thinking they're practicing mindfulness, being very still, very calm, but they're completely ignoring the reality around them. Well, Shantideva says, no, you respond. So don't let mindfulness become another version of self-centeredness. There's even a discussion here of putting aside a lesser precept for a higher precept. This comes in this section. That the Bodhisattva will, from time to time, if necessary, put aside a lower precept for a higher precept. You get that in the precepts that Dada Rinpoche gave to Bhante, that you're willing to break the lesser precepts for the higher precepts. And Bhante talked about his own experience of this in India. He was a pretty strict monk with his Vinaya, not eating after 12, not eating after midday, but sometimes spreading the Dharma in India, particularly among Dr. Ambedkar's followers, lunch would be quite late, or the Dharma talk would be quite late in the day, and he was quite happy to let go of the not eating after 12 rule in order to teach the Dharma. Or perhaps more pertinently, more poignantly, really, when he was a young monk, when he was first teaching with the so-called ex-untouchable Buddhists, he would often be touched by women, especially older women. And of course, a monk can't come into any physical contact with a woman. That's regarded as a downfall from his precepts. And Bhante thought about this quite deeply, and he thought, no, that wouldn't be good to observe that rule in relation to these women who want to touch his feet and make contact. It wouldn't be good because it would be perpetuating untouchability. That contact was very important for them. So he was happy to let go of that minor rule for the higher rule of compassion and connection. You know, and I found that very touching, very moving. To hear that. And we have to make sure, of course, that we don't rationalise this kind of idea, you know, that you put aside a lower rule for a higher rule. But maybe there are areas where sometimes we have to do that. We have to put down certain things we, as it were, cherish, which we think are very important, for a much higher, a much more important action. He talks in this section as well about doing everything with a heart fully involved in completing the task. Whatever you do, whatever it might be, you do it thoroughly, you do it well, you see it through to the end. This is part of mindfulness. You know, if you're cooking, you do it well, you do it thoroughly. If you're washing up, you do it well, you do it thoroughly. If you're cleaning, you do it well, you do it thoroughly. If you're doing the books, I'm looking at you and our wonderful bookkeeper over there, you do it well, you do it thoroughly. All of the kind of work represented here in the room, it's all part of mindfulness, to see the job through to the end and to do it with full attention and full awareness, and do it with a good spirit, a good attitude, a good heart, and don't let the defilements come in. If you're not wholehearted, the defilements will come in and take you over. It's very interesting. Termo Geshe Rinpoche, the tulku of Lama Govinda's teacher, he didn't get out of Tibet. He did eventually get out of Tibet, but very, very sadly, he was incarcerated in a Chinese work camp under terrible conditions, and really, really suffered very, very badly. And he was a good friend of Bhante's. Bhante got to know him, said he was quite a mysterious man, but a very, very good man. And he asked him how he survived in the camp, because, you know, you know, if you showed any sign of doing any Dharma practice, you were punished and beaten very, very severely. And Termo Geshe said, I did whatever work I was given really well. I did it really thoroughly, and he became so trusted. That was his practice. He ended up, I think, running the laundry, working in the laundry, working really hard and really doing everything well. That was the way he practiced. That was the way he practiced his Bodhisattva vow, with that quality of mindfulness and awareness. Shantideva does address the whole area of what I've called inhibiting reactivity. Inhibiting reactivity. And here we have that bizarre image that people often remember from the Bodhicharya Avatara, becoming like a block of wood. So let's see what he's got to say about becoming like a block of wood. It doesn't sound very attractive, but I want to just address it because I think he's actually making quite a good point, an important point, actually a very good point for me. When one wishes to move or speak, first one should examine one's own mind and then act appropriately with self-possession. When one notices that one's own mind is attracted or repelled, one should neither act nor speak, but remain like a block of wood. When the mind is inflated or derisive, full of arrogance and vanity, exceedingly jocose, evasive or deceiving, when seeming to advance oneself, it is only deprecating others, contemptuous and scornful, one should remain like a block of wood. My mind seeks acquisitions, reverence or renown, or again, wants an audience and attention. Therefore, I remain like a block of wood. My mind longs to hold forth. Good one for me. Averse to the good of others, seeking my own advantage, longing only for a congregation. Therefore, I remain like a block of wood. It is intolerant, my mind, idle, cowardly, impudent, also foul-mouthed, yes, and biased in my own favour. Therefore, I remain like a block of wood. It's actually really positive, being like a block of wood. I mean, all those states of mind he's described, I know them all, and I'm often in them. And it would be a jolly good thing if I could be more like a block of wood. A block of wood. Kashtavat. A wall of wood. A wall of wood. A block of wood. It's as if he's saying, look, just get a hold of yourself. Just hold in that thing you so desperately have to say. And if you don't say it, you're going to go mad. How many times have I said that thing which I thought, if I just say this, everything will be all right. And the mess that just radiates out into the room, and the horrible sort of shame that I feel in relation to that. Or worse still, that dreadful email. Those words that just come up on the screen where you're really sorting somebody out. If only they weren't said. If only I could have really been a block of wood at that keyboard and just didn't do anything rather than say those words. So I think he's seeing as something, this is something very positive, and you have to feel it as something positive, being like a block of wood. It's something powerful, actually. You know, perhaps even if you don't like the idea of a block of wood because it's so insensate, maybe think of being like a great tree, like a great oak or an ent, you know, for those of you who are into Lord of the Rings, who move very, very slowly and don't make decisions rashly. Just hold it in. Just hold it in. You won't do any damage to yourself. You won't do any harm to yourself if you hold it in. If you have to talk about that thing that could lead you into difficulty, go and speak to a close friend who, you know, who will take it in the right way and objectify what's going on. But practice like a block of wood. He then goes on to give more of a positive vision of the mindfulness of the Bodhisattva and how the mindfulness leads to samadhi. Noticing in this way that his mind is defiled or engaged in a fruitless activity, the hero should always firmly curb it with the antidote to that condition. So it isn't just about being a block of wood. Also apply the antidote to that state. Block of wood is perhaps the beginning, but then you've got to develop the positive. develop the antidote to what's going on. Then he goes a bit further, a lovely description. Determined, full of serene confidence, steady, full of application and respect, with humility and timidity, calm, eager to help others, unwearied by the mutually conflicting desires of the spiritually immature, full of compassion, knowing that they are like this as a result of the arising of defilement. See, always in blameless matters, I shall keep my mind at the will of myself and other beings, free from delusions like an illusion. At every moment, continuously mindful that it has taken so long to gain the best of opportunities, this is how I shall keep my mind, as unshakable as Mount Sumeru. Mount Sumeru being the central mountain, the mountain at the centre of the known universe, known geography. So really central, the central mind, very, very steady, the centre of the universe. This is what we should be doing. This is what mindfulness is for, this indestructible quality of mindfulness and concentration. He then talks about analytical meditation. I think Shantideva actually is describing mindfulness leading to shamatha, to calm abiding in meditation. And then he does brings in analytical meditation that comes after shamatha. And there's a purpose for this particular meditation, this particular reflection. He takes the Prajna Shastra, the knife or the sword of wisdom, to reveal the composite nature of the body, its impermanence and insubstantiality. And he does it unsparingly. It's quite graphic with the sword of wisdom. Just open up your body. Just take it apart. Crack open the bones. Take out the intestines. Lay it all bare, to discover that there's no essence to it. It's impermanent and insubstantial. I'm not suggesting you should do this at home, folks. It's a strong practice. We have a gentler but still a very powerful version of this in the six element meditation. But one of the things he wants to do in this, it's not just for its own sake. Shantideva's got a very sort of appreciative yet critical stance on the body. He said, look, this body, you can't rely on it. There's nothing to it in the end. In the end, it's food for jackals and other beasts in the cremation ground. Its only use is to benefit others because of the mind. It's the mind that's the really important thing. It's the bodhicitta that's the really important thing. Give the body what it needs, sure, but no more than that. He says things like, the body's like a labourer. You just give it enough wages so it can feed itself and clothe itself, but no more. No pampering, no overdoing it in different ways, because it's the mind that's really important. It's the mind that you should be developing. Okay, of course, we do need to take care of the body with exercise and healthy eating and live in a healthy way, but we do that for a higher purpose. We do it for the purpose of the bodhicitta. He says in another place, in the same place actually, that the body's like a ship to carry the mind through life. The mind is in command. The mind, the bodhicitta, is the captain of the ship. The body will pass away. It arises and passes, but it's the bodhicitta, the mind, that carries on. So we really need to master our nature in this way. And then there's a wonderful passage which really, I think, describes beautifully the mindfulness of the bodhisattvas. It's one of my favourite passages in Buddhist literature, actually. One's own nature mastered in this way, one should always have a smiling face. One should give up frowning and grimacing. Be the first to speak. A friend to the universe. That's wonderful, isn't it? The first to speak. So he's talking about mindfulness of others here. a smiling face, not going grinning like an idiot, but smiling because there's a deep happiness and a real awareness of other people. And the first to speak, putting people at their ease, making them feel okay, making them feel comfortable. And then he talks about mindfulness of things. One should not throw down stools and other furniture violently with a crash. One should not pound on doors. One should always delight in silence. So there's this cherishing of things all around us. One should always delight in silence. We had a silent morning this morning. The crane, the cat, or the thief achieves his intended goal by moving quietly and gently. The spiritual aspirant should move in such a way at all times. It's a very, very attractive description, isn't it, of mindfulness. Moving like a crane, well, a crane moves extremely slowly to get that fish. And the cat, well, we've got lots of cats in our garden, they really move so well to get the birds and the mice and the little rabbits. And the thief, of course, has to be really, really silent. So he takes these things. Well, let's learn from them positively, how we are to move and act in relation to grow on the path for the benefit of all. One should respectfully receive the advice of those who are able to direct others, who offer unsolicited aid. One should be the disciple of everyone all the time. So a very profound receptivity to others. One should express one's appreciation of all that is well said. When one sees someone doing good, one should encourage them with praises. So really encouraging people. One should speak of others' qualities in their absence and repeat them with pleasure. And when one's own praise is spoken, one should reflect on that person's recognition of virtue. So if somebody praises you, well, that's great. That's wonderful. But the real thing to acknowledge there is that someone else can recognize virtue. He takes out any kind of sense of becoming conceited through the praise of his virtue. One should speak confident, measured words, clear in meaning, delighting the mind, pleasing to the ear, soft and slow, and stemming from love. This is one of my very favourite verses in the Bodhicaryavatara. I'm even going to try and say the Sanskrit because the Sanskrit sounds so lovely. I won't be able to do it properly, but let's have a go. Vishvastavinya stappadam vispashtartam manoramam shruti saukyam kripamulam mruddu mandasvaram vade. Really lovely. One should speak confident, measured words, clear in meaning, delighting the mind, pleasing to the ear, soft and slow, and stemming from love. This is mindfulness. This is mindfulness of communication. He goes further. One should always look at people directly, as if drinking them in with the eye, thinking, depending on them alone, Buddhahood will be mine. This is such an amazing verse. Really taking people in and realizing that it's because of other people that you can become a Buddha. Because love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, tenderness towards others are intrinsic to enlightenment. Friendliness and friendship are intrinsic to Buddhahood. They're not add-ons. So other people are enabling you to become a Buddha. They're not just kind of things on the edge of consciousness. They're intrinsic to the path to Buddhahood. So really take them in. Really take them in. Really value them. One should be able and energetic at all times, acting on one's own initiative. In all actions, one should not leave any work to another. So this brings out the mindfulness that the Bodhisattva takes initiative, doesn't leave it to others passively, but really gets in there and takes it on. Really, really wonderful passage. Very, very beautiful indeed, I think, that description. And, you know, when Bhante talked about Dada Rinpoche, he really sounded like that. He really sounded like somebody like that, who was really acting out Shantideva's teachings. He goes on further. We're coming now to the end of the talk and the end of this section. He talks about the ethics of a bodhisattva and, you know, the different precepts that a bodhisattva takes. There's quite a lot of discussion of the different precepts. There are Mahayana sutras. We tend to think of Mahayana sutras being very cosmic and symbolic, but there are many Mahayana sutras which describes the patterns of a bodhisattva's morality. It's very, very important, it seems, in the Mahayana tradition to sort of establish a code of ethics, rather like the code of ethics you find in pre-Mahayana Buddhism, rather like that, really trying to, as it were, model a bodhisattva's behaviour. So Shantideva mentions all these. But he sums up, you know, if you like, what it's really all about. One should consume in moderation and share with those in difficulty, the helpless, and those observing the vows. And apart from one's three robes, give away everything. That's what it all comes down to. So it's really the bodhisattva monk's life he's describing. And the principle is living very, very simply for the benefit of others. He goes on to talk about the immeasurable conduct and training of the bodhisattva. There's, as I say, all sorts of precepts. They're all expressions of mindfulness. And he also talks about a whole training. He says confession is very important to the mindfulness of a bodhisattva. He mentions the Triskanda Sutra, which was a very important sutra of confession to the 35 Buddhas of confession. He said you should practice it three times a day, at least, this ritual practice of confession. And I'm sure Shantideva would have also talked about the importance of actually confessing to spiritual friends the things that you've done. He recommends texts for study to get a sense of the bodhisattva's conduct. He recommends his own Shiksha Samuchaya, the compendium of training or the compendium of discipline, which has his root verses, but lots and lots of quotations from different Mahayana sutras. He mentions another text by Nagarjuna called the Sutra Samuchaya, which I don't know if it actually is still extant, but it's a collection of different sutra extracts to describe the bodhisattva ideal. So in other words, Shantideva's mindfulness, his total awareness, his protecting, his guarding of total awareness, is a total Dharma training that involves not just mindfulness, but study, meditation, communication. It's a whole life. It's absolutely everything. It involves puja, confession, everything. That's the context. He says, one should do nothing other than what is either directly or indirectly of benefit to living beings. And for the benefit of living beings alone, one should dedicate everything to enlightenment. Never, even at the cost of one's life, should one forsake a spiritual friend, a Kalyana Mitra, who upholds the Bodhisattva vow and who is skilled in the meaning of the Mahayana. So this is very, very important. You never let go of your spiritual friends. You never let go of those who are exemplifying the Bodhisattva vow. He regards this as absolutely essential to this training in gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, because it's the spiritual friends that keep you inspired, that keep you instructed, that keep you on the Bodhisattva path. One should also practice towards teachers the correct conduct according to the Sri Sambhava Vimoksha. Both this and other things taught by the Buddha should be understood by the recitation of the sutras. So there's that whole thing of the sutras. The Sri Sambhava Vimoksha is from the Gandavyuha Sutra, which describes Sudhana's Bodhisattva path. And it's rather delightful because Sri Sambhava is a boy And Srimati is a girl. That's how they're described in the text. And they teach the youth Sudhana how to serve spiritual friends, describing all the different ways in which you should serve the Kalyana Mitras so that you can learn what the Bodhisattva path really is. You learn the Bodhisattva path from others. The Sri Sambhava Vimoksha, very, very important text in the Buddhist tradition. And finally, Shantideva says, in brief, this alone is the definition of awareness, the observation at every moment of the state of one's body and one's mind. I should express this by means of my body, for what use would there be in the expression of words? He really wants to embody this teaching. For someone who is sick, what use could there be in the mere expression of medical knowledge? Thank you.